The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD presents Campus Voices, conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon.
You know what I was thinking about? I was thinking about going to Poe Night. We're going to be doing the costume party, and I was thinking about rather than going in costume as I did last year, I would just go in character. And so I was thinking that what I might do is go in the character of Blanche DuBois, which is really more obeying the spirit than the historical period of Poe's Southern Gothic. And I believe that since our theme is bad romance, that Blanche DuBois' bad romance is with herself and her inability to change.
Oh, yes. Plus, there's just so many other individuals to choose from. You might as well just do Blanche DuBois.
Well, that was what I was thinking. And besides that, I've spent my life trying to run for the more pernicious elements of my Southern background. And I've decided that for one night, I might let them catch up with me. And believe me, that is scary enough for at least a dozen Halloweens.
Thank you so much for joining us, Blanche DuBois, who in real life is University of Delaware English professor April Kendra. And joining me in the studio is one of her students, Sarah Craster. Say hi.
Hello, everybody. It's good to be here.
Well, since you started the show before I could even introduce you, let's talk a little bit about some of the things you teach here at the university.
Well, I mean, the most famous thing I teach is Women's Studies 205, Vampire Culture, or What's Really at Stake. And I have to apologize. What can I tell you? It was very late when I was coming up with this, and I was very punchy. It was 2:00 in the morning, and then later they wouldn't let me change it. So now I'm kind of stuck with that.
I think that's wonderful, though. So do you go back further than Mary Shelley?
We don't actually go all the way back to Mary Shelley. We usually begin with Bram Stoker. We usually begin with Dracula. And I always make it clear, it's not that vampires begin with Dracula, far from it, actually. But if we don't begin at the end of the 19th century, we'll never make it up to things like True Blood. And I know that that's what the students are really waiting for, Buffy and True Blood. So, and Peeps, you know. So, you know, they want to do some 21st century stuff. So we begin with Dracula because it is so influential, and then we move forward. So I've never gotten to go back as far as Mary Shelley, actually.
Now, vampires have been part of legend all throughout the world for millennia.
Yep. And in fact, the longer that I have explored vampires, and I like to say I have spent more time thinking, reading, and writing about vampires than any healthy, well-adjusted adult should. But as I have been exploring this, I realized that it's not really in the past decade or even the last century that vampires have been huge in popular culture. They've really been dominating popular culture for at least two centuries, you know, probably beyond that. But I can really trace it in Western popular culture, in British and American, for at least two centuries. And so this to me says this is not a craze. This is not a fad. This is not even a trend. That is a full-blown genre. You know, that's anything that can command that kind of attention for over two centuries is worth exploring. It's obviously meeting some kind of cultural need. It's speaking to us, not always in the same way and not always, you know, for the same purpose, but it's obviously filling some kind of need, and it's worth exploring what that is.
Does it fulfill some of the same needs that imaginative science fiction does or other kinds of fantasy writing, or does it get at something deeper and darker?
I don't think I would say that what fantasy is doing is shallow. I think that that those are all getting at something very deep, not always the same thing. But yeah, I think that it's worth paying attention to the stories we tell ourselves because they are revealing of something else. I mean, the most obvious sort of narrative that vampire stories give us is a question of, is there life after death? You know, what is the relationship of life and death? And of course, the issue of good versus evil, and that's, you know, that never goes out of style. We never stop thinking about that. That never stops being important to us.
It's almost like it's the kind of fiction where there's this one thing you need to suspend your disbelief about, the vampire story, and then all the rest of it is eternal themes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, and even if you look at something like one of the things I've taught is Scott Westerfeld's Peeps. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. It's a young adult novel. So Scott Westerfeld likes to write imaginative, you know, he writes science fiction, but it always has a really firm grounding in science. And so Peeps reimagines the vampire in a very science fiction-y way. Peeps stands for parasite positive. So all of the characteristics that we associate with vampires, sensitivity to light, desire for blood, night existence, you know, that sort of thing. These are all explained by the parasite. And then every other chapter is about real parasites that exist. Toxoplasma or, suddenly I can't remember any others, but it, you know, so looking at different kinds of parasites and how they work and how they affect their host organisms, how really vile and disgusting and nasty they are, and the kind of mind control that they can even create, parasitic wasps. So these things, if these things are real, are vampires really a stretch? You know, that's one of the things that we're thinking about. And if we can see that in the insect world, and most of the parasites that he discusses are parasites of insects, so they're very, very small, but they can change the gender or the sexuality of the host organism.
Wow.
They can change the behavior of the host organism. I was thinking about toxoplasma. Toxoplasma is something that likes to live in the stomach of a cat. And yes, and it winds up in what is left in the litter box. And as you are scooping out the litter box, it can get up your nose and into your brain. Doesn't actually hurt you. Doesn't seem to have any negative effects, but it may change your behavior. And one of the things it may do is make you like cats more, which is why one cat leads to another. So he's looking at these things. These are documented. These are real. So he's using that both to say, how much of a stretch, as I said, you know, are vampires, but also to be thinking about these dominant metaphors of vampire as parasite or vampire as predator, and thinking about how these are, again, part of the natural world, how we act as parasites, how we act as predators. So it is sort of creating this space for the vampire as a metaphor for things that really are part of our natural existence.
There are two vampire novels that I enjoy a lot. Mm. I don't know if you taught them or Sarah, if you're familiar with them. The two set in San Francisco by Christopher Moore, Bloodsucking Fiends and You Suck.
I have wanted to read them. I've heard of him. I haven't read him. Would you recommend them? Why would you recommend
absolutely.
Them?
Absolutely. They are hilarious, but it's also the vampire interaction.
Uh-huh.
Is, I mean, these are people mm-hmm. who just happen to be vampires.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one bites another, mm-hmm. and he's furious that this woman has turned him into a vampire, and it goes from there. And they have all sorts of adventures all over San Francisco. And some of the characters also show up in Christopher Moore's A Dirty Job, which is about someone who finds out he's now a soul catcher, mm-hmm. where he has to go and get an item that a person's soul has gone into when they die. Yeah, those are dark comedy, mm-hmm. to say the least, where it's the vampire is part of the dark comic action,
mm-hmm.
not like mm-hmm. the Anne Rice novels that one of my ex-wives used to read, you know, where it's part of the Southern Gothic. It's almost an extension of Southern Gothic in
mm-hmm.
some ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I learned to appreciate Interview with a Vampire, which I've taught many times. I think Anne Rice is extremely influential of the vampire tradition. You know, sort of this, and actually that's what I teach after Dracula, and I talk a little bit about what happens in the 1960s, Dark Shadows especially, but also the Addams Family and the Munsters, as this way of allowing us to identify with a vampire rather than the vampire hunters or the vampire killers, you know. And so we're getting this idea of the vampire as somebody who might be lonely rather than evil. You know, the vampire is somebody who might be, you know, different, but again, not necessarily evil. And what the Munsters and the Addams Family both did was create this very domestic circle for the monsters. And we see that they're just ordinary people. And so the laugh is on those people who could actually be afraid of them because they just don't understand them. And so, and then we get Anne Rice telling the story completely from the viewpoint of the vampire, which is the one viewpoint we don't get in Bram Stoker's Dracula. So we get this shift so that now we're being asked to identify with a vampire, and we're being asked, rather than to see evil as something that's external, that's over there, it's those people, and so we have to go after them and do something about it, it's within. And the question is, what can we do about that? You know, are we able to conquer this evil within ourselves.
Well, before I ask Sarah about your course, Women's Studies 205, and you better say the title because I'll blow it.
Okay, it's technically Women and Gender Studies.
Excuse me.
That's okay. We changed a while back. So Women and Gender Studies 205, and it's Vampire Culture, What's Really at Stake?
So you haven't taken her class.
No, I've taken one of her classes.
But you haven't taken that class.
Vampires.
But you've had friends who have. How did it affect your friends?
They really got into it. And because at first, like, people go into the class and they're not inclined to take it very seriously because, you know, it's vampire culture and it's fantasy. And, it's just for fun. But then they get into it and they look at some of the issues involved. Especially, like, I remember somebody talking about, like, how sexuality is portrayed and, mm-hmm. like, how it carries over into real-life relationships. And also, kind of tying in what you said earlier, the vampire as, you know, are they a creature of evil? Are they just acting according to their, you know, evolutionary paradigm? That sort of thing. So, yeah, there's been a lot of discussion that these classes have evoked.
What class of Professor Kendra's have you taken?
Oh, I took her American Literature Survey, which was also very nice. I think we started with 1700s about, especially with some of the Native American encounters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we ended, you know, late 20th, maybe early 21st century, which also actually got close to Native American literature with a lot of Sherman Alexie.
That's right. I was thinking, what did we end with? But it was Sherman Alexie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You teach American Lit from the 18th century to the 21st century in one semester?
Wasn't my choice. That's the structure of the course.
Wow.
That's the structure of the course. We have a single American Lit survey.
But two Brit Lits?
But two Brit Lits, right. Well, because the first Brit Lit goes from Beowulf to 1660, and the second one is supposed to go from 1660 to the present. And depending on how you construct American literature, it's not as old as that.
Do vampire stories have their origin in oral literature? Does it come from myths?
I remember this was just kind of a little side project, actually, but it was around Halloween, and we were looking into some of the original vampiric folklore. And one of the areas we went back to was Slavic. And in the mythos, it was very different than what we were expecting. I suppose we were expecting Bram Stoker again. But instead, we had these spirits who possessed corpses if funeral rites weren't carried out properly. And one thing that really struck me was the window. Because looking at vampire literature where, you know, oh, a vampire can only come in if it's allowed, and why would anyone leave the window open? What's going on? The idea was if you did not have the window open when somebody had just died, then their spirit was trapped and they couldn't get out. And then they would become one of those malevolent spirits that then possessed reanimated corpses and fed on people's blood. So that was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just blown away. I mean, it's, you know, we are going to air this interview the Thursday before Halloween of 2015.
Ooh.
So this is all spooky and scary and fits in with that theme. But it's, I think it's important for me to say that this is also important in the history of our culture and
mm-hmm.
our literature.
Mm-hmm. No, I absolutely agree. And I think that, for example, I'm very excited about teaching this course, a version of this course in Italy. Next semester, I'm going to be doing Vampires in Volterra as part of the semester abroad in Tuscany, 2016. And we're going to be talking about a lot of things. One thing I hope I'm going to get to address a little bit is there are two researchers from the University of Florence who were doing, they were anthropologists. They were doing some work, and I don't remember the name of the island, but it was off the coast of Venice. And they were looking at a leper colony. They were looking at a graveyard and leper colony, and they believe that they have found evidence of a ritual, not exactly a slaying, but, you know, a ritual that's supposed to prevent a vampire from rising. They found a skeleton with a brick wedged into its mouth. And so now the blogosphere went crazy about this, and people were saying, see, I knew it, vampires are real. And then they got in trouble with their colleagues who were saying, oh, they're sensationalizing this research. And I don't think that that's what they meant. They weren't saying vampires were real. They're saying the beliefs about vampires were real. And I believe this is, I want to say this is 16th century. But this belief that that this person had become a vampire was probably related to plague symptoms. So we have these stories about people who have committed suicide rising as vampires, people who, you know, have suffered from some terrible contagious disease as vampires. I have even found references to this argument that after corn was brought back from the New World into Europe and became a very popular staple because it was easy to grow and it was easy to dry. And so it was, you know, sort of a way that people could feed themselves fairly inexpensively. But they didn't know the Native American way to treat the corn so that it would release niacin. And so it may be that, no, we know that the result was a large number of people who got pellagra. I can't remember how to pronounce that, pellagra, but it has to do with a vitamin B deficiency. And a lot of the symptoms, bloody mouths and sensitivity to light, scaly skin, things like that, this too might have been one of the origins of vampire legends. So, you know, there are plenty of scientific explanations for how these beliefs got started.
That's incredible, because I just always heard the most popular origin I heard spread around was, you know, premature burials and, like, people being very scared by what they would see as a result. But that kind of, like, crossed, like, because of American corn coming back to Europe, buttressing the pre-existing European myth. That's really interesting.
Yeah. I've learned that, as I said, vampires as metaphor were really important in the 19th century. And what I found is, you know, people always point to certain literary works. Byron's The Giaour, for example, includes a reference to a vampire as a kind of curse, that somebody is going to be doomed to come back to life and feed on his wife, his sisters, his daughters. You notice it's all female victims. So he's going to be destroying his own family, recognizing that he destroys them and unable to do anything about it, right? So you have Byron, you have I See Christabel by Samuel Taylor Coleridge as a vampire text. You know, we look at Barney the Vampire, which is a really terrible penny dreadful in mid-century. Yes, Barney the
Mid which century?
19th century.
And that's called
Barney the Vampire. and then, let me think, Carmilla. By Sheridan Le Fanu, and then Stoker's Dracula. So those are texts that people always look at. But what I'm finding is that vampires were kept alive in a theater tradition, and we tend not to pay that much attention to the theater tradition. And so those are, you know, those were so popular that vampires actually became a really popular metaphor for describing economic exploitation. You know, if you had a landlord who was extremely greedy and was basically bleeding his, you know, his tenants dry. Sure. Let me think. I found it in Dickens. Actually, this is interesting. I was reading Mystery of Edwin Drood, and I was thinking, every time I think, okay, I've spent way too much time thinking about vampires, I'm projecting, I'm seeing vampires where no vampires exist. And then I find proof that I'm not making this up. They really are this interested in vampires. I was reading Mystery of Edwin Drood, and this character who's definitely set up as a villain, John Jasper, seemed to me to have a lot of characteristics of the 19th century vampire. And 19th century vampires are different from 20th century and beyond vampires. 19th century vampires are very sensitive, not to the sun, but to the moon. So it's not that they're allergic to the sun. It's not like they're going to burst into flames, but they draw power from the moon. And you think about the moon as being changeable. You think about the moon related to lunacy. You know, so the moon is what gives them power. And if a vampire is killed, if his body is exposed to the moonlight, it can bring him back to light. I'm sorry, back to life. So moonlight is this very potent force in 19th century vampire texts. And there are many, many references to moonlight in Dickens' Mystery of Edwin Drood. There were some other things. You know, one of the big ones is that our heroine is afraid of John Jasper. She says she feels like he's a ghost who could just materialize anywhere and he could pass through walls, right? This is something vampires did in stage productions. In fact, there was something called the vampire trap, which was a very specific kind of trap door. It was a spring-loaded door, and you sort of pressed on it and the panels would slide apart. And it was especially effective when it was put in the wall of a set so that the human actor could seem to pass through the wall. And then when I was thinking, okay, I really am going too far here, and then I began looking at Dickens' journalism and found that he had lots of references to vampires. So he was actually talking about vampire traps. He was very familiar with the theater stagecraft. He was talking about there was a really cute story about him staying at a really terrible hotel and something that was, it must have been either fleas or bed bugs, but some kind of insects that were tormenting him all night. And he talked about them as the brown jacketed vampires feasting on his fair flesh. So there was a famous book, Mrs. Beaton's Book of Household Management. Mrs. Beaton, Isabella Beaton, was sort of the Martha Stewart of the 19th century. She had advice for the new housekeeper on just every aspect of keeping house. And she had some advice for young mothers that new mothers should make sure that they had their baby sleep in a separate crib and not in the bed with them, because if the baby slept in the bed, then it would be very easy for the baby to be nursing and the mother to fall asleep. And I mean, some of this is 19th century medical pseudoscience, but you know, she seemed to think that if the baby continued nursing after the mother was asleep, then the baby wouldn't really get much nourishment from the milk that it was drinking, but it would leave the woman, the mother, exhausted and depleted and in pain. And just when I was thinking, sounds like she's calling this baby a vampire. And again, I was thinking, okay, I've really got, intellectually speaking, I've got to get out more. And then I turned the page and it said, and therefore the ministrations to the baby vampire. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, so it really was in people's consciousness. You know, it was in the forefront of their minds. So this is not a new thing that we're talking about. This is not a new preoccupation.
Sounds to me like, I mean, this is not the only root of it, but part of it is, you know, from the same kind of thing where people say, ooh, the volcano's erupting, so the gods must be angry with us. I mean, the kind of, well, here's some things that they don't understand about the world, and so they create a mythology around it, and part of that mythology is vampires.
I think that's true. I think that we also use it for things we understand very well about people who act as sexual predators, you know, who are acting out of a desire for domination. You know, we see it again. I was thinking about the economics, you know, thinking about that sort of exploitation. So, you know, I begin thinking about vampires as anything that drains, anything that takes more than it gives. And you don't have to venture into the realm of fantasy or science fiction to find examples of that. It's a really helpful metaphor to be able to sort of see this is an unhealthy relationship. This is an abusive relationship, whether it's between an employer and an employee or between, you know, in a romantic relationship, whatever it is, if one person is constantly taking, you know, if one person is draining, and it doesn't have to be blood, it can be money, it can be energy, it can be optimism, it can be self-worth, you know, it can be any of these things. And then we look at the myth of the vampire and these stories about things that you were talking about, opening the window. Mm-hmm. So the vampire has to be invited. So this idea that the victim is somehow complicit in his or her own exploitation, you know, are there ways in which you have invited this or you have allowed it to happen? And then that sort of puts you even further into the vampire's thrall because you're beginning to think, I deserve this. You know, I made this happen.
But you're going to Italy.
I am.
not to Transylvania. I mean,
I am. I'm going to Italy. Here's an interesting thing about Italy. So where we're going is Volterra. And for people who are fans of Twilight, then they already know that Volterra is the home of the evil Volturi family in the Twilight Saga by Stephanie Meyer. And because it's so popular, it's such a popular series, it's been such a popular movie series, there is this whole vampire tourism industry that has grown up around Volterra. There are people who go there just because it's in the books or it's in the movies. And I think that the city of Volterra has done something really savvy, which is that they're aware that people want to come because they're interested in this. And so they have crafted tours. They have crafted, you know, tourism literature, walking tours and things like that. And what they've tried to do is very carefully pay homage to, you know, Stephanie Meyer's vision of Volterra. They know that this is what people come for, but they also want to talk about the actual history. They want to talk about Volterra, which was originally an Etruscan city, so it's actually older than Rome. It has very strong connections to the Medici family in Florence. So, you know, it is this very old, very rich, historically rich city. And so their strategy has been, they come for vampires, we give them Volterra. So they're trying to give actual history and create these spaces for, you know, there were these dark presences, you know, a a lunatic asylum or prison or something like mm-hmm. that. You know, there are these ghost stories or there are these legends. And then they say, who knows, perhaps it could have been a vampire. And then they sort of borrow from Stephanie Meyer's mythology. So they're walking this very thin line. And on the one hand, you can say, well, that's very exploitative, or it's very, it's cheapening their history. On the other hand, this influx of tourism dollars has really allowed Volterra to weather some difficult economic recessions that are hurting other cities, of its size. So that's one of the things that we're going to be looking at, a very different way of thinking about vampire culture. I often think about sort of the culture of vampires, the way vampire stories are sort of reflecting on our own vampiric tendencies, what this says about our culture. But here I'm thinking about how they are presenting their culture. Is this sort of fabricated folklore? Is this, pop culture way of thinking about Volterra? Is it somehow sucking or taking anything away from Volterra's real history?
It sounds like what they're doing is using the pop culture as a hook.
Sure.
And then telling people mm-hmm. about their history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, which, like I said, I think it's very savvy. I think it's very clever.
It's not a Disneyfication of the history. It's using the pop to get them mm-hmm. to learn the real history.
You want to hear something funny?
What's that?
The movies, the Twilight movies, were not actually filmed in Volterra. They were filmed in a nearby town, well, maybe an hour drive, Montepulciano. So it's represented as Volterra in the movies, but the images that we have are not actually of Volterra. And I think this is hilarious that... go ahead.
Montepulciano has also tried its own hand at marketing and trying to invite Twilight fans to come and to celebrate the vampire mythos. However, they have been considerably less successful than Volterra. And you can see the attempts if you look into it. But again, with the economy and everything, it's really not going that well. It's pretty ironic, just because they're obviously using different marketing strategies. Mm-hmm. But Volterra is still having a very strong advantage, perhaps because they actually have this very rich Etruscan Roman Medici mm-hmm. history to go with it. So. Mm-hmm.
No, I think that's very possible. And like I said, I haven't been. I'll let you know when, I've been there and I've made my comparison and I can come back. But what I'm hearing is that Montepulciano has been very crass and sort of heavy-handed in its attempt to appeal to the vampire fans. So it's coming off as very...
Gimmicky,
yeah, tourist trappy. Whereas they think that, Volterra, I think they appreciate the history, the part that, some of this is authentic. And that there has been this space and this very, I think, respectful attitude toward the mythology that Stephanie Meyer has created.
Time has just flown by. If we were all real vampires and we could live forever, we could continue this discussion. Maybe we'll have to continue it another time.
I would love that. As you can tell, I can talk about vampires for a really long time.
But I think they are iconic figures in lots of different cultures.
Sure.
And they do, as you say, they present some really interesting metaphors for things that perhaps you couldn't write about sexual exploitation in the early 18th century.
Right.
But you could write about vampires.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I think, and my students are always surprised at how very sexual and not necessarily sexy. It's not always in a good way, particularly when we're looking at Stoker's Dracula. But certainly the bite is figured as sexual very early on. And so from the beginning, we have an awareness that he is able to talk about sex and fears about sexuality, particularly fears about women's sexuality, in ways that might be unacceptable if you were trying to address it head on. But this metaphor, figurative way of approaching it is more acceptable, so he can get away with it.
Sarah, thank you so much for bringing your professor.
It was definitely a pleasure.
And April, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I've enjoyed it very much, and I've loved having Sarah with me. This is great.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.